Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name is Patrick Gray. On this week's show, we're taking a look at the backstory to the Image Magic bug. There's a bit more to that one than has been reported so far, so we'll be chatting with Ryan Huber about that. He's a security engineer at Slack, and he was certainly involved in bringing that bug to the public's attention. This week's show is sponsored by BugCrowd. Big thanks to them. So in this week's sponsor interview, we're joined by Casey Ellis, BugCrowd's CEO. We are also joined by Katie Masouris, the former chief policy officer from HackerOne. She's now a freelance bug bounty consultant working across the whole industry, and she's got some interesting stuff to say about where all this bounty madness is headed. We have a chat about what she's up to, why she launched a consulting business, and I get Casey and Katie's thoughts on what the next 5 years could look like in bug bounty land. But before we get into all of that, it is time for a check of the week's security news with our good friend Adam Boileau. And Adam, we've had some more interesting and lulzy info come out of the hack, or the $1 billion hack of Bangladesh's central bank. Apparently, they're pinning the blame for this onto consultants from SWIFT itself. But the lulls don't stop there, because as it turns out, there were like multiple groups rattling around the network. And because they rolled incident response because of this incident, like, they found all of these other people sort of lurking in there. It's like, you know, it's like lifting up the rock and seeing all the eyeballs peering back at you.
Yeah, well, I don't think anyone is surprised that there are a bunch of people up in bank networks. I mean, of course, yeah, once you go looking, you just do start to find things. But they're pinning the blame on SWIFT consultants. It's quite funny. They're asserting that the consultants that set up their SWIFT environment didn't bother setting up good firewalling switching, like the cheap, you know, $10 switch that they were using, they just found lying around the bank. And then there was apparently like a locked room where some of the SWIFT equipment was, and that was super inconvenient. So they just rolled up a wireless network with some D-Link or whatever and used that, so they didn't have to go in and out of the secure room to work on the SWIFT system, and then left it there once they had finished their work. You know, that kind of thing, which I'm sure surprises absolutely no one, because this is pretty much situation normal.
But the funny thing about this is everyone's going, lol, Bangladesh, ha ha ha, poor country doing stupid things. But it's like, this, how many times have you seen this on engagements in, like, you know, rich countries?
Well, I'm sure it's the same consultants from SWIFT that are going around and doing these implementations all over the world and getting paid the same amount of fat bank, you know, whether it's third world or first world. And I'm sure people outside this industry would love to believe that first world banks are way better, but our listeners are not from outside this industry and know the horrible, awful truth.
So maybe a little less ha-ha at the Bangladeshis, I think, is the moral of the story. Vice's motherboard blog is reporting that multiple arms of the US government have issued so-called cyber espionage alerts. This is FBI, DHS, and DOD. And as the headline says, you don't see this often.
Yes, you don't see coordination amongst American government departments particularly often. That is the takeaway from this particular article. Whether or not this is actually unusual in terms of its content, of its subject material, there being an apt group doing the rounds, owning people, I don't know that that's super surprising. But the coordination is interesting, perhaps.
It either means it's a super serious campaign, or finally some coordination stuff that started with a meeting 5 years ago has kicked off.
My 5 years does seem rather too short a time frame.
Yeah, it seems a bit speedy, isn't it? You know, there you go. Yahoo, meanwhile, has released a second tranche of unsealed Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court documents. Now, this dates back to when Yahoo challenged the US government over aspects of some of their intelligence programs that sort of roped them in. In 2007, it seemed that the US government finally threw down and just said, look, you know, you're going to play ball, or we're going to fine you $250,000 a day. And, you know, Yahoo has been battling ever since for more transparency on this. And yeah, some more documents coming out, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, so they've released the second set of documents, which from their side of the court proceedings they went through with the FASC court. And I think the interesting things there are for people looking in at the actual process, rather than the that particular request being from 2007, I guess, is less interesting. But the process by which the court operated, by which, you know, the sort of the resources Yahoo had to be able to kind of argue their case in that court, and the sort of procedural stuff is quite interesting.
Yeah, the word that springs to mind is Kafkaesque.
Yeah, well, exactly right. And we get to see what a ridiculous farce of a process it is, which is, you know, is useful for informing the kind of debates we are having at the moment about oversight. Mm. But yeah, also nice to see Yahoo, you know, actually contributing something useful to the internet for a change. So that's
you mean besides Yahoo Answers?
besides that, I'm sure they have many other fine products or services.
Mm.
I don't recall seeing one in a while.
Twitter has revoked access to its feeds, API access, I imagine. It's revoked the access of Dataminer, which is apparently some company that provides all manner of terribly, you know, privacy invading, spooky, you know, world dominating services to the US intelligence community.
Yeah, so this is a company that it analyzes the like real-time feed of data from Twitter, and apparently is the only company to which Twitter provides that data. And Twitter owns some percentage of that organization, and then they generate, you know, like real-time things are going on, news alerts based on the contents of the tweets and mining and that kind of thing. And they had some kind of project or relationship work that they were doing for Incutel. That project ended, and now Twitter is saying that they're not going to do further work. They're not going to authorize data miners to use their data for further work with the intelligence community, and that the intel community can go piss off and mine their own data. Which clearly they are quite capable of doing, and it will probably be much more intrusive the way that they end up doing it, viz, you know, owning Twitter and stealing it.
Well, I've just got a mental image of an NSA guy pulling on a scuba suit at the moment, you know, to go and drop in a tap at the right spot.
Yeah, well, I mean, clearly the Intel community is not going to go, oh, well, I guess we're not going to look at their data anymore. They're going to go find some other way of getting it,
yeah,
or, you know, a better way of getting it. Nice. But, you know, it's kind of nice for Twitter to do it, although whether it materially makes much difference, I don't know. But, yeah, it's, you know, I suppose a sign of the larger unease between the tech community, you know, tech industry in the US and their own government.
Well, it's symbolic, isn't it? Know, it's symbolic, right? Because it's public data, right? So it's not even like this is private stuff. It's just they're saying, no, we don't actually want to be a part of this anymore. The Yahoo stuff's interesting as well because it shows that as far back as 2007, they were actively fighting this sort of stuff, which kind of counters the narrative from a lot of people, which is that, you know, Silicon Valley were these willing collaborators in all of these, you know, surveillance programs. It, you know, it just really doesn't seem that there's a lot of data to support that.
I mean, yeah, certainly amongst some of the more hipper, and I hesitate to use Yahoo in the word hip these days, but once upon a time they were quite hip, you know, and it's nice to see that that does go back sometime, that, you know, that kind of hacker ethos, you know, is at least somewhat alive and well in the Valley.
Turning our attentions to Florida, and David Michael Levin, 31, of Estero, Florida, has been charged with a raft of computer crime offences because he thought it would be a great idea to roll SQLI on an election website because I think he's like chummy with one of the candidates in the election. And yeah, it's all sort of backfired on him and he's facing charges. Can't say I'm terribly surprised given the way that he rolled Disclosure, which was to sit down and do interviews with one of the candidates talking about what a bunch of idiots the government is for running vulnerable like election websites. What do you think of this?
Yeah. I mean, what a moron, really. I mean, if you will make YouTube videos of you like live hacking an election website, you kind of got to expect it's not going to go well, even if you are friends with, you know, other people who are running for election at that particular point in time. It just isn't going to go well. And of course, yeah, he SQL injected some rubbish website, you know, logged into it, poked around, recorded video of him doing so, and then, as you say, gave interviews and all that kind of rubbish.
Who'd have thought that filming yourself committing a crime would be a bad idea? I mean, I'm blown away. I am blown away. It's crazy. It's anyway, a crazy, crazy world.
Perhaps he has learned a valuable lesson. It does appear that the particular Florida county's election office has not learned any valuable lessons, as they were, you know, kind of writing it off as being uninteresting and saying, well, it was an old box and we were going to decommission it. It wasn't doing anything important. I'm sure it's totally not connected to any of their other systems. And there'll be no way to move laterally once you've got an initial foothold. But anyway, I don't know that they have learned their lesson, even if Mr. Levin perhaps will.
Now, last week we spoke briefly about PwnedList. This is one of those Have I Been Pwned style websites that apparently got owned, or, you know, there was a serious vulnerability that got disclosed, which hinted at the idea that it might have been owned. They've pulled the pin now on the entire operation. That has just disappeared. The people who managed it have said, in fact, that they were planning on pulling the pin anyway. I mean, whether or not you believe them or not, doesn't really matter. The point is that that website's gone now. But we've got two more stories here from Vice that I want to discuss because they kind of underscore some of the risks involved with operating websites like this. There have been two breaches involving, you know, very sensitive account information. One is for a dating site called Fling, where users enter their sort of sexual desires and things like that, very private stuff. So, you know, those email addresses and usernames and things like that, it's not the sort of stuff that those users are going to want out there. The second website deals with a slightly more niche sexual activity. There is, I mean, how do you say it? There is a website out there apparently that focuses purely, like it purely exists. There's 100,000 people who use it. It's a forum that purely exists for people who are into anal fisting. And they've been owned and now all of their creds are with Troy Hunt in his website.
Well, and you would think that if you're going to sign up for that, that maybe you wouldn't use your work address.
But people don't think like that. They don't put those, they don't connect those dots, man, you know?
Well, I mean, clearly that's a lesson that they're going to learn. You know, if you work at .gava.mil and you sign up for anal fisting websites with your .gava, your .mil address, then I guess this is a lesson that you are unfortunately in the process of learning.
But even if it's with your Hotmail account, the point is that this is very personally sensitive stuff. Now, one thing that I'm concerned about is we did see, you know, Pwnlist being hideously vulnerable. Now, Troy Hunt's taken this information, he's ingested it into Have I Been Pwned. He does not store hashes of the email addresses. He stores the email addresses themselves. Now, I had a quick chat to Troy this week, and I'm like, well, doesn't it worry you that you might actually be the sole repository, not suppository, for this information? Doesn't it concern you that, you know, if you are the sole repository of this information, that someone might actually hack your website and then this information, you know, and sift through this information and do nasty things to the people who signed up to that board. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think these credential dumped creds websites, I don't know that they're entirely thinking it through. Like, I think storing this information is a bad idea.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with you. I think, you know, it's one of those things that starts off easily, like you collect a couple of dumped password files to use in your own, you know, to generate word lists for your own cracking, and then you got 5 or 10, and then you start correlating them or, you know, deduplicating them, and then before you know it, you're the sole repository on the internet for all of them. And yeah, you don't necessarily think through what that means for your personal threat model, and obviously if I was Troy, you know, I would have a number of concerns about how I would robustly secure that data and, you know, the risk that that would present to me. I don't know that I would run one of those.
Yeah, I mean, I just would think the obvious thing to do would be to bcrypt hash the lot and just not store the email addresses, which does make by domain email searches quite difficult, which if you're looking to offer enterprise services into the future, that's a problem. But if you're offering it as a public service, there's no reason to store the email addresses.
Yeah, and I mean, there are plenty of mechanisms for storing data that's hashed and encrypted but still searchable and sortable. I mean, that's just computer science. And that particular problem of, like, figuring out which domain, like, you could break it up and hash the domain part separately from the local part. There's all sorts of...
Well, that's kind of what I suggested to Troy, yeah. Yeah, but I mean, this is...
Yeah, all sorts of options.
I just think it's a, you know, I don't want to see one of these sites get sort of popped and then mirrored again. I don't know. It just... I know the data is already out there technically, but I think once you start aggregating enough of this stuff, you become a pretty juicy target in your own right. So let's just hope nothing bad happens there. Turning our attention now to some ransomware, the CryptXXX ransomware. Kaspersky released an unlock tool, and now the people behind the malware have patched it. So we're interested. We're watching an interesting little, arms race there.
Yeah, well, I guess it's the sort of the classic AV arms race between the virus writers and the AV companies, except now that it's, you know, crypto ransomware instead of traditional antivirus. But yeah, it's not clear that their patch in this particular case solves the kind of the root cause of the way that the crypto works in this particular malware. So Kaspersky may, take the next step and be able to decrypt it again. We'll have to wait and see.
Meanwhile, Lockie, which is a very prolific bit of crypto locker ransomware, someone's been having a little bit of fun with their distribution networks, Adam.
Yeah, apparently someone someone on one of the boxes that's actually distributing like the second or third stage bit of the Locky loader, someone replaced the Locky with a text file that just says stupid Locky. So when it goes to download the next stage, it just gets that instead of the actual binary. And it's not clear whether someone's owned part of the distro network or whether it's just someone whose box had been taken over to be used. The distro site was cleaning it up and, you know, decided rather than just RMing, they would express themselves. We don't know yet, but yeah, obviously that's, you know, it's pretty funny.
Well, someone out there might be having a bit of a chuckle, and good for you if it was you. Microsoft and Adobe are both warning of some ho-ho-ho-ho day out there, which is apparently in the wild and being actively exploited. I mean, this is turning into a weekly headline, which is, you know, there's a lot of people rolling pretty hard out there at the moment.
Yeah, well, obviously flash bugs are a long running thing, and there's seemingly an infinite supply of O-Day in that, which, you know, I guess if you were sitting on a bunch of them, given, you know, flash reaching its end of life, you'd probably want to use them a bit more aggressively, which might explain some of the uptick. I mean, there's less incentive to hoard them, and much the same with IE. The Windows bug was a one in, I think, the J script, like the pre-JavaScript scripting engine in IE, and that's another bug that if you had sitting on the shelf, it's got a short shelf life these days with Edge and Microsoft's work and improving their browser life. So yeah, maybe people are just pulling down some of their rainy day stash and using it.
It's like mag stripes in the US. Like, let's go. You know? Yeah. Windows 10. Apparently, they have killed. Microsoft has killed this Wi-Fi password sharing feature that, like, everyone kind of thought was a pretty dumb idea to begin with. And apparently, they've listened to market feedback or whatever, however they want to put it, and they've killed that feature. But this was a feature that enabled you to share like your Wi-Fi access creds with your friends on like Outlook or something. I don't know. The whole thing seemed like a kind of a shit idea, to be honest.
It was a dumb idea then, and it's still a dumb idea now. But yes, apparently the latest insider like preview build of Windows 10 has dropped that feature. Whether or not that is because they just broke it in this build, or whether, and it may come back, or whether it is actually gone for good, we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was dumb, and maybe it would now be less dumb.
You got to wonder how that got up. Do you know what I mean? Like, I just can't imagine the security group going, yeah, guys, that's a great idea. Like, let's do that. You know, I just can't see that. So you'd think this would have been a point of conflict, and then maybe a management call would have said, you know, no, we're going to ship it. It seems like a cool idea. I'm sick of writing down passwords when I go to my friends' houses, you know, like just has that feel to it now. Yeah, egg on faces everywhere. Anyway, Tavis Ormandy has been having a bit of fun on the Twitters. I'm sure that the Symantec PR, like if they were actually clued up enough to follow Tavis, which they're probably not, would be having a heart attack right now. But they're sitting around blissfully unaware, still collecting license fees. But yeah, as it turns out, Symantec Endpoint, not very good.
Yeah, obviously Symantec Endpoint has had a pretty checkered history and is super widely deployed. I mean, everyone still uses Norton Antivirus for reasons that escape me. But yeah, Tavis found a whole bunch of straight up vanilla Stack Overflows, like remotely exploitable Stack Overflows in the Symantec Endpoint Protection client, which would be fine had they compiled their software with stack cookies turned on. But because Symantec clearly live in the year 1997 AD before we invented, I don't know, like stack exploit mitigation technologies, like stack cookies, they turned that off.
These are straight up Stack Overflows, like popping shells left, right, and center as at privilege, like no problem.
Yes, like it was the year 2007 AD or whatever. And it's what year is it again? Sorry, I think it's 2016 Symantec. Yeah, could at least.
Does this shit run a system?
Well, of course it does.
Yeah. That's just great, guys. Really well done.
Top stuff.
There's a Qualcomm bug apparently affecting mostly Android. And look, it's just another Android Privesque bug, but it's really doing the rounds in the media and everyone's sort of doing a lot of arm flapping over this. But it's pretty standard Android Privesque fare, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't know why this particular bug is getting traction. I mean, other than like maybe Qualcomm's brand recognition, I don't know. It's good for them. Yay, marketing, right? This is just vanilla local Privesque via some of the Qualcomm, you know, kind of driver and support code, and means that, you know, local apps can ask Priv, which, as you know, as you say, is just every day on Android. And it's Android like 4.3 and earlier. So not, it's straightforward on 4.3 and earlier. It may be more complicated on later versions. But, yeah, just regular common garden Android bugs. So
don't see what's moving from – and moving from a Common Garden Android bug to Common Garden Android supply chain issues, Adam.
Yeah, apparently Allwinner, a Chinese company that makes like integrated system on chips using, you know, ARM CPUs for Android devices, mostly kind of tablets and things. Mm. They had a kernel, had a backdoor in their like standard OS, Android OS build they provided, where apparently you send the text "root my device" to some debug process, and it gives you like kernel level code exec.
It does what it says. Hey, it does what it says on the box. This is fantastic. Root my device, roots your device.
And from a company called Allwinner, you know, you've got to admire their you know, their commitment to having, you know, clear names that mean what they want.
Mm. Apparently there's a Android malware campaign doing the rounds out there, which is doing ad fraud and helping to carry out DDoS attacks, which I thought was kind of interesting. I mean, how much DDoS like firepower are you going to get out of a fleet of Androids?
Well, I mean, I guess there are a lot of Androids. I mean, if there's a billion devices, then even a billion devices on the cell net, you know, might be able to throw a few packets around. But yeah, you wouldn't have thought that, you know, battery-powered radio-connected devices would be your first choice for a DDoS botnet. But hey, I mean, I guess you take what you can get.
Beggars can't be choosers, that sort of thing. Is there anything novel about this one, or it's just meh?
Well, I mean, not really. Just, you know, Android malware seems pretty normal. I mean, using it for DDoS seems dumb, but people have been Bitcoin mining on Android malware. So, you know, anything's possible. I don't know if there's anything particularly exciting there.
Now, this next story is kind of interesting. It looks like someone's figured out how to use SS7 protocol flaws to man in the middle like a WhatsApp connection.
Yeah, so I wasn't super clear. I mean, the thing they've got here is by using SS7 attacks, they're man-in-the-middling SMS messages. And then from there, using that to kind of get into the initial key exchange identity verification bit of the kind of the WhatsApp identity components, where it uses SMS to exchange some initial like identity and keying before then talking over IP for the rest of the messaging. So by running up a SS7 whatever trick they're using to get in the middle of the packet data context and the SMS, they're then able to impersonate someone else across the cell network. And of course, your the messaging app, WhatsApp in this case, has a cached fingerprint if you've previously communicated with someone, and that will be different because you don't have to get the key material. You're just getting in the middle of the ID. So, you know, most people might not notice that. I'm not sure with the WhatsApp UI specifically how noticeable that is.
Ah, this is interesting. The FCC and FTC in the United States are finally, it looks like, cracking the whip on the Android ecosystem, saying, hey, guys, why don't you just sit down and explain to us how it is that you distribute patches.
And amen, like about goddamn time. We've seen the FTC, you know, really come down pretty hard on some of the other, I mean, we saw it with like webcam vendors and home router vendors. Was it TP-Link, was it, who got the...
I can't remember. You know, some rubbish vendor, yeah.
Yeah, someone got that, you know, very stern kind of, we will audit you for the next 25 years and you will not use the word secure on your packaging anymore, et cetera, et cetera. Right. And you consider how harsh they were on, you know, a relatively smaller industry. I mean, the, you know, web, you know, webcams at home or whatever is not a massive industry compared to the size of the Android ecosystem. So the FTC rolling into this particular hood hopefully has all of the carriers and all of the Android vendors, you know, really quaking in their boots. I mean, Google, I imagine, must be quite happy about it because, like, their problem is the carriers and the vendors.
No, their problem is they architected a system and a business model that enabled this sort of shitty behavior, man. Like, you cannot let Google dodge culpability for this. It is totally their fault.
It is their fault, although I don't know that, I mean, clearly Google is capable of doing a good job of things, but Chrome...
Yeah, but they wanted to get to market because Apple and iPhone and we got to be there. Like, that's why they did this. They could have waited. They could have thought about it and done it in a better way, but they did not. They did not.
Yes, and... No, I agree. They clearly did not. And now they are stuck in a very, very difficult place. And I think they kind of need some help to really whip the carriers into shape and whip the vendors into shape. And maybe this will be it. And the FTC rolling around and demanding billion-dollar settlements or something might be the kind of stick that they need. you know, it does give them a chance that they don't currently have, I think, to fix, you know, to fix their house.
Well, I just think it's about time, and it feels like, you know, not that I'm normally one to say, yay, the government's getting involved. I mean, that's not the sort of thing we normally like to see. But in this case, you know, it's a clear failure and, you know, go FCC. But it does certainly feel like Android nastiness is accelerating. I mean, does it feel like that to you as well?
Well, I think so. And we've got the – well, I think it's accelerating in the sense that we have this installed legacy base of a billion phones that we can't patch. And those are going to be a liability into so many other things because phones are used for so much other stuff. Like they provide a window into other things. So the value of those phones is very high in terms of compromising them, and they're never going to get patched. So, yeah, of course, the and as other things are getting difficult, man, Windows 10 – pretty good, iOS pretty good, Android's left as the place where you can still work your hacker technique with a lot more ease. So I think naturally it is going to pick up and is indeed picking up.
Yeah. Stefan Esser, meanwhile, has released a really cool little tool for iPhone and iPad. It's an iOS tool that lets you detect certain jailbreaks, which is just a fantastic idea. And it sort of picks up anomalies. Like if your OS is doing something funny, it'll tell you. This is a great idea.
Yeah, no, it's certainly a very useful tool because you don't have much visibility as an end user of an iOS device into its innards. And obviously, Stefan Esser is uniquely placed to understand the innards of iOS devices. So having him and his team put together a tool that looks for signs of jailbreaks, looks for process injection, looks for extra libraries being loaded, things that otherwise you have no visibility of, is really useful. And apparently the this particular app, it's called the System and Security Info, apparently it's going all the way up the iOS App Store charts in the US in the paid app section. So the fact that there's that much demand for it's amazing. I hope he's making fat bank out of it.
Making fat stacks of mad cheddar, yo. SAP. Now, this is interesting. Apparently, a bunch of attackers have been targeting a SAP critical since 2013. And it's like people are starting to notice. And they're like rolling incident response and going, oh, shit, we got owned via SAP. Kind of interesting, right? Because I remember seeing or chatting with some of the guys from SensePost a few years ago about SAP. And it's just it's a place where nobody really looks, but there's lots you can do with SAP, like on the wire. And as it turns out, you can use it to own stuff as well.
Yeah, no, SAP is a real kind of, den of iniquity in there. There's so much nasty Java. And yeah, as you say, so many interesting ways to attack it across the wire, directly against the server. And once you're in, you get all sorts of wonderful things. I mean, I saw a talk, it must be 5 or 6 years ago from some Argentinian guys who've been working on building tools to hack SAP, and they were super effective, across a number of vectors. And I imagine that's actually probably the tool chain this particular set of attackers is using. You put enterprise Java software like SAP on the internet or even, reachable internally, then of course it's going to end up getting shelled horribly. But, the fact that people are getting popped by SAP bugs from 3 or 4 years ago when SAP releases, like 30, 40 patches a month for this stuff really does give you an insight into how much attention SAP systems don't get from a regular patching and maintenance point of view. Not that it would help.
Well, the Oracle syndrome, which is they don't want to break it, right, by patching it. Don't patch it, Jesus. And there's I love the quote from this report into this bug, which is the exploitation of this vulnerability gives remote unauthenticated attackers full access to the affected SAP platforms, providing them with complete control of the business information and processes run by them, as well as potentially further access to connected SAP and non-SAP systems. So, that's about as clear cut as it gets, eh?
Yes, that is impact high, I think is what we call that one.
Yes, that's right. Hey, it's nice that we're actually getting to the point where we're talking about people getting owned through their enterprise apps, because that means they're not just getting owned by the millions of bugs in their Windows boxes anymore. So that's cool.
That's true, yeah. They're not getting drived by, IE malware or malicious Office docs with, macros attached.
And maybe all of your bugs in Tivoli and CA will be worth something now.
Maybe they will actually go up in value. I mean, all those vintage bugs I've been hoarding, I won't have to take them to the bug op shop.
You've been hoarding them for the good part of a decade. Don't take them to the op shop. They'll be worth a bunch. Hey, Facebook has done something awesomely cool. I know so many people who run cons, people like yourself. And when it comes time to roll, a CTF, like there's a lot of reinventing the wheel. There's a lot of drama involved in setting up a CTF. Facebook have launched a CTF, have released their CTF platform, and it's free. So yay, Facebook. Thanks for the gift.
Yeah, no, this is really cool. This is their like the game engine for running a capture the flag, and they've got it on GitHub for you to have a play with, and then you kind of insert your own levels into it. But it takes care of all the registration and the web interface and the scoring and all that kind of crap. And having written exactly that myself for you know KiwiCon 2, 3, 4, 5, whatever it was, it is so much work. So yeah, this is great if you're thinking of running a CTF for your con. This is absolutely worth considering rather than reinventing the wheel. So yes, go have a look.
Now, of course, this week's feature interview is with Ryan Huber, and we're talking about the image image magic bugs, you know, and you'll hear him suggest that perhaps graphics magic is a better alternative because image magic looks pretty wobbly any way you look at it. But I understand, and I got a blog post from Mikhail Zalewski here just talking more about image magic and, you know, what a big pile of shit it is. But we were chatting before we started recording, Adam, and you said there's, PHP GD?
Yeah, so the GD library is another graphics processing library, and it's the one that's used by default in like my most PHP developers. Someone posted a remote like heap overflow exploit for GD on Linux, exploitable through the, you know, the PHP front end where you're processing images that have been uploaded. So yeah, all of the PHP people who are smug about not using image magic, yeah, having a bad time. Apparently the same guy's got a bug in the zip handling library for PHP as well. So we're going to see a few shells popped.
I did a bit of Googling on that one, couldn't find it. So you drop me a link and I'll drop that into this week's show notes so people can go have a look at it. We should point out too, Frack is back after a four-year hiatus, I guess. Frack issue 69 is out. Link in this week's show notes. You can go check that out if you would like. And of course, another periodical, which was released this week, is the 2016 DZIR from ThreatBot. The Danger Zone Incident Retort is out, and it's a really, I mean, it's pioneering work in the field of threaty threats.
Yes, absolutely. I'm glad they have recruited the help of Kenny Loggins' security team to help them with their Danger Zone security report. It has a lot of valuable information about hacking and computers and computer hacking and indeed threats in the butt, I gather. So that's well worth reading, especially if you are one of those people who had their accounts pwned on a forum.
It is pretty lol. I would recommend that you go and have a look at that. And it's fantastic donut charts and all of that. So, yes. But Adam, that is it for this week's news. Thank you very much for joining us as always, and we'll chat to you again next week.
Cheers, Pat. Talk to you then.
That was Adam Boileau there. Big thanks to him for that. Now, we're going to talk a bit more about the image magic bugs. Ryan Huber is a security engineer with Slack in the United States, and he's part of the team that disclosed the bug to the wider world. He was also in on the decision to give the bug a name, a logo, a website, and a Twitter account. And he joined me for an interview to explain why the hell they did that. Long story short, they tried disclosing without the fanfare and no one paid attention. But when they gave it a brand, it went gangbusters. It's depressing, but it's true. Now, Ryan and the disclosure team didn't actually find the image magic bugs, and he was a little bit cagey on where the bug info actually came from. He just said a person reported it to them. Well, after I recorded this interview, I did some actual journalism and figured out in broad strokes how this thing actually became known about. Basically, people were using the image magic bug in the wild in bounty programs. A few of the companies running the bounties compared notes and saw that they were getting owned quite a lot via image magic, and a collective decision was made to blow the whistle on this one before the exploit moved away from legit bounty participants and towards more criminally oriented attackers. In other words, someone decided to ruin the party, which probably explains why Ryan didn't finger the person responsible and why the person responsible wants to remain anonymous. So there you go. It means a few things kind of make sense there. Anyway, Ryan joined me via Skype to talk about the behind the scenes on this one, which culminated in the disclosure team actually branding the bug to great effect. As it turns out, the bug didn't really affect Slack, but as word got around, Ryan realized that it was a pretty big deal for a lot of people.
So we were chatting about this internally and decided we weren't overly concerned about it. But then in some of the other security Slack groups, and you know, just because I work at Slack, I'm in a number of these groups, there was chatter about this, and you know, it started this whole back channel discussion where lots of people were involved. And actually, a lot of companies were affected by this. So a lot of companies, I think people would be surprised to hear were affected, were actually impacted by this bug.
Yeah. Now I understand that you know, a few people you were in contact with went out, you know, knowing this exploit existed, had a bit of a sniff around their own networks and found people actually exploiting it. Like they found DeadSet, Netcat, you know, callbacks and stuff using ImageMagick bug.
Yeah, exactly right. So what's happened now is that people are going back and looking at the images others have uploaded, and it's really easy to scan for this bug. So a number of people are going back and looking at those image uploads, especially for things, like I said, like profile photos. And they're actually finding that people were at least testing this, and there's some indication that some of it was nefarious as well.
So at that point, you guys decide, hey, it's not our bug, but we're going to have to sort of disclose this, because at the time, the people behind ImageMagick didn't even know about this, right? You were all talking about it. They didn't know they had O'Day being exploited in the wild.
So it turns out they did actually know at that time, but we didn't have a direct line of contact with them, and we couldn't really see any evidence that they had fixed the bug yet. So We went looking around, and we actually spun up another discussion group and just invited the stakeholders we could reach. So we had people from the distros in there. We had the original bug finders. We had a number of people. And we just started chatting about what the impact of this bug might be. And we found out that there were actually already CVEs assigned to it. And the embargo, I believe, I may be getting this wrong, but the embargo was supposed to be lifted on the Friday. But given the information we had, we decided that as a group, we decided that it made a lot of sense to disclose a bit early.
So at that point, you guys write a Medium post saying, hey, there is a serious bug in ImageMagick and everyone needs to pay attention to this, right? And there was no, you know, you didn't name it. There was none of those shenanigans. It's just, hey, pay attention to this.
Yeah, so we made a little joke at the bottom in the FAQ saying, if you must call it something, call it this. We actually joked at the top of the post that, let me pull up the quote because I thought it was a little bit funny. There is some irony in announcing vulnerabilities related to an image processing package and not giving them logos, but here we are. So that was actually at the very top of the post. So we, you know, it was a bit of tongue in cheek, and we went from there. So we posted this article to Medium, and before we actually posted it, we decided we'd disclose it around 10 a.m. Pacific time. And before that, we decided it would be a good idea to queue everyone up. So, you know, put a tweet out there that gets a bunch of retweets and just tell people we're about to announce something that may affect you, like good chance it affects you. But unfortunately, we couldn't even name ImageMagick because we started looking at the commits, the recent commits in the Git repo, and realized that if you looked within the last, I think it was 10 commits, you would know exactly what the bug related to within a few minutes. And one person actually, you know, didn't have the exploit in the group when we started talking about it. And I think it took them something on the order of 10 minutes to discover the exploit from the commits.
So what did you do at that point? Did you hold off on the Medium piece, or did you publish it anyway and just not name them?
Yeah, so actually, ImageMagick posted to their forum at something like 7 a.m. Pacific that there was a new version coming, and there were also some security issues, and gave some recommended mitigations. And I don't think very many people saw that. I don't have any numbers, obviously, for their forum, but they actually did disclose this first in a way. And so, you know, following that, we decided, because we debated internally, should we disclose this or not? This isn't our bug. Also, this isn't our software, right? So we're sort of a bunch of security people. Should we talk about this publicly? And once ImageMagick actually posted that to their forum, it was kind of a done deal. So they posted that at something like 7 a.m. We sent the tweet that to expect something at 9 a.m. and then at 10 a.m. posted that Medium article. So at right around 10 a.m., I published the Medium post, and then we sent out a tweet, and then we asked a number of people, friends in the security community, to retweet that link.
And this tweet named ImageMagick, and I'm imagining that the patches were coming later that day.
Yeah, so there were some patches already in the code base, but they were incomplete, and that was kind of known to everyone involved. So there were patches that pointed to what the problem was, but they didn't solve all of the vectors of attack. And what we did have, we had a good set of things that we knew were effective mitigations. So limiting the delegates, if you're familiar with ImageMagick.
So you rolled out the Medium post with a bunch of mitigations and said there should be some patches coming soon, sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly right.
And then it kind of fizzled a little bit, didn't it?
Yeah, so it jumped pretty quickly. A number of people retweeted it. And then I know Hacker News is kind of a silly indicator, but it is one way that people in tech get the word out. And there were a number of people that submitted the Medium post and the tweet and whatever to Hacker News, but they all sort of languished on page two, and then they would die off. And we saw a number of these sort of trail off and never make it to the front page even. And so we were a bit worried that, you know, this is out there and a lot of people know about it. More people are going to have this exploit, you know, any hour or any minute now. And we'd like to get the word out a bit faster. And so we did the thing that we didn't intend to do and joked we would never do. And that was we created a website and we named it. And one of the people actually in the discussion group had the night before as a joke modified the Image Magic logo and just replaced the M with a TR. And we all had a good laugh about it. And we actually ended up using that logo on the website.
So you've given it a name, you've given it a domain name, and you've given it a logo. And then what happened?
And don't forget the Twitter account.
And a Twitter account. The report.
Yeah. So you know, within minutes, and unfortunately, you know, the stats are a bit hazy because Medium doesn't give me sort of hourly stats. But as soon as we flipped over to the website and gave people pointers to that, you know, we had thousands of views within a few minutes. And a lot of that was sort of driven by, I think, the Hacker News article that shot to the top. But, you know, various reasons, it became very popular very quickly.
So basically, when you gave it a name, then all of a sudden it got traction on Hacker News.
Yes, that is unfortunately true.
So on a scale of 1 to 10, how depressing did you find this experience that it actually worked? Because honestly, this shouldn't make a difference, should it?
Yeah, a little bit, but I think there were some unique bits to this case. So one of them was just how trivial it was to exploit and the fact that this was very much being exploited in the wild. I think some of the previous instances we've seen of people, you know, hyping up bugs and giving them names, it's something that they talk about a month later. And I think that's a very different case than this. We actually just wanted to get the attention in any way we possibly could. And I think, you know,
I'm not attacking you. I'm certainly not attacking you for what you did in this case, right? Because it deserved the attention. It honestly deserved the attention. But don't you worry that in an industry that's supposed to be stuffed full to the brim with intelligent people, that you have to distract them with logos to make them pay attention? I mean, it surprises me that publishing the details on something like this isn't enough to get it spread widely.
Yeah, I think that's true to some extent. It's also easy to ignore something like a Medium article that someone posts unless you sort of ring the alarm bells in some way. And there's not really, you know, we have a good number of mailing lists and discussion groups and places to disclose this information, but there's nothing that's really the equivalent of an internet fire alarm, right? So it can be hard to get the word out rapidly.
Did you try engaging with the media at all?
So I chatted with HD Moore about the bug pretty extensively the night before we disclosed. And HD, I think, can, you know, sort of shared the information behind the scenes with a few media people just so they would have articles queued up. I actually don't know exactly who he spoke with, but there were quite a few. I think there were four or five articles before the Image Tragic website went up. And, you know, those articles got decent traction as well.
How much of an impact would you say that naming the bug actually had?
Oh, I don't know that I could even venture to guess. I mean, I can give you the raw numbers, and that's kind of an indicator to me. So the Medium post, and by the way, the Medium post is still there. It's just in an edited form that links to the bug website now. But the Medium post received a total of 23,000 hits, and the Image Tragic website itself has received 148,000 hits. So again, I've mentioned this to you earlier. This isn't an apples-to-apples comparison because one came after the other and there are a lot of variables. But it definitely, you know, it seems like it might have been on an order of magnitude more interesting once it had a website and logo.
So where does this leave us in terms of whether or not this is a practice we should stamp out? Because, you know, I mean, you would have heard, I know you listen to the show, right? And here we are bleeping out the names of other named vulnerabilities and saying, as a style rule, we're just not going to do it anymore. And then along you come with this bug and just show that, well, you know, it works.
Yeah, I feel a bit bad about it because I very much agree with your sentiments on that. And I think we've been burned by it a bit more recently, right? You know, so things like the thing that involves the word lock. I don't know how to say it.
Recent SMB vulnerabilities, I think you're talking about.
Yeah, that's the one. I think we're a bit burned by that recently, but in some cases, it is a useful mechanism to get the word out. The problem is there's no barrier to entry. So anyone can take any vulnerability they like and sort of, you know, present it in this fashion. And I think that's really the detrimental factor here.
It's funny, you know, I read a tweet a while back saying someone suggested that we're going to, you know, after we run out of good names, we're going to have to create some sort of database where we can refer to vulnerabilities via numbers.
Yeah. That's
crazy that's a good idea.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
I just wonder where this leaves us. Do you think we're going to keep going with named vulns until eventually it just stops working? Because I honestly thought we'd jump the shark with bad lock. Do you know what I mean? And then you have come along and done this and sort of it seems like this is going to draw it out longer. But do you think it's a practice that's going to die?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, so Haroon actually had a really good response to one of the tweets I sent out, and he referred to it as the tragedy of the commons. And I think that was a really, really good take on it. And it's something where you can't compete with named vulnerabilities effectively if you just send out the technical details right now, and that's unfortunate. And there's a bit of a backlash there, but I don't know where this game ends, whether it'll just continue as sort of, you know, one-upsmanship or how this will play out. We had a part in promoting a bug, and it is what it is, but I really have no idea what this is going to look like in another 6 months or a year.
Now, in terms of the bug itself, obviously you would be tracking, I guess, the uptake in patches and maybe getting a little bit of intel from various sources on whether or not people are seeing it fixed. Is it getting fixed as far as you know, or you don't have much visibility?
So a number of people in security reached out directly, and we actually recommend a further mitigation to a lot of the people that we talk with directly, which is to whitelist which of the items you allow. So the mitigation listed on the website is actually a blacklist of things we know are vulnerable. But if you only support a few image types, it's much better to whitelist just those few image types. It'll leave you with much less attack surface. And one of the things we've seen on ImageMagick's post, they've actually updated it a few times to add in new delegates that you should block. And, you know, that tells us they're finding new issues as they go through the code base. So as far as how many people have remediated the bug, you know, I think it's been substantial within the sort of tech community, but this is one of those bugs that is going to live for a very, very long time, especially in sites that aren't, you know, maybe maintained by a tech-heavy company.
Well, and I sort of wonder whether or not it's the type of bug that's going to pop up in appliances and things like that, like, you know, all of your border, you know, load balancers and things like that. You know, you never know. There might be some stupid function in there which enables administrators to upload an avatar, you know, and then bang, there you go, like command injection straight onto a border device. I mean, do you think we're going to see it in things like that as well, like embedded devices that just won't get a patch?
Yeah, one of the fun things about chatting with some people is they actually spent a good amount of their time during remediation just trying to figure out where this thing lived within their environments. Yeah. So a lot of libraries call it, and you know, a lot of people don't realize that. So some people might think, oh, I use this image processing library, it's not related to this bug, but behind the scenes, it's using ImageMagick.
So I can see this as being one of the ones that the bug bounty participants are really going to enjoy into the future, because it'll be one of those, the first things they check, and they'll probably get decent hits on it.
Yeah, definitely if you install anything outdated, and I don't know, we may actually have full patches for all of the known issues, but the other effect here is that I think ImageMagick, we now know that it's pretty popular based on how many people were interested in this bug, and it's going to have a lot more eyes on it as well.
Yeah, right, and who knows what that's going to turn up. Are you hinting at something there, Ryan?
No, definitely I'm not. My interest in ImageMagick is limited to this little disclosure bit. But there, looking at the code base, there's some interesting stuff to be had there. And luckily, there are some alternatives out there, like GraphicsMagick and some others that are trying to improve that story a bit.
Yeah, and I'm sure they're heaps better, right?
Well, we actually had the chance. So the GraphicsMagick maintainer actually joined us in the security discussion group and had some really valuable input. So he seems to really care about, you know, cleaning this up. And there's already a lot in the GraphicsMagick code base that has done away with some of the issues that led to this bug.
Well, maybe that's one for the Web 2.0 or 2.1 or whatever the hell version number we're up to now. The web, the modern web people to have a look at. Ryan Huber, yeah. Thank you very much for joining us on Risky Business to have a chat about you know, your involvement in the disclosure of the image magic bugs.
Yeah, thanks very much for having me.
Ryan Huber there. Big thanks to Ryan for that. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now. This week's show is brought to you by BugCrowd. BugCrowd has been a sponsor of this show for years now, from its very early, early days. And in that time, we've watched BugCrowd pioneer this entire new industry, an industry that is more or less dominated by BugCrowd and its main competitor, HackerOne. Katie Masouris was the highest profile security bod on staff at HackerOne, where she served as chief policy officer. But these days, she's working for herself. This means working with all of the bug bounty providers, from her former employer to BugCrowd, and a couple of other more niche players. Now she's in a cross-industry role, Casey suggested we do a double-barrel interview on this week's show. So joining me now, together, are Katie Masouris and Casey Ellis to talk about what sort of consulting she's doing and what sort of initiatives organisations need to roll out to run successful bounties. I started off by asking Katie what a bug bounty consultant actually does. What are people asking her to help with?
So it depends on the client. Some of them are already doing bug bounties and they want refinement on the incentives that they're doing. And they want, you know, some advice on what it is that they're targeting among their applications and, you know, and the prices and things like that. So some are already doing bounties and they need consulting on that. Some are thinking about doing a bounty, but they really have no capabilities, engineering wise or otherwise, to fix the bug. So I kind of have to work with them for a little bit longer. And most organizations are somewhere in between. So they will typically say, you know, we've been running our vuln disclosure process for a while. We've been wanting to do a bug bounty. We have way too many products to bounty all at once. You've done them in gradual steps for organizations like Microsoft. So can you help us like figure out our first targets? So that's kind of how the conversations go.
Now, it seems a lot of this is about being response ready. And this is a theme that I've heard consistently, both from Casey and people who've actually been doing bug bounties is, yeah, they launch a bounty, they get a flurry of inbound information that they're not quite equipped to deal with. It seems, Casey, that bug bounty programs are what is changing organizations' approach to response. It's like they actually have to have a well thought out response mechanism before they can do this. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that we've been talking to customers about a lot is the idea of using this this approach to identifying vulnerabilities as a forcing function for the rest of it, if that makes sense. So, you know, on one hand, it's like, okay, get ready, be able to do a program where you're accepting information like this at scale. But then if you can't get that thing done, it becomes a bit of a, you know, chicken and egg debate, at which point, you know, the whole idea of, okay, let's get more eyes on target. Let's find vulnerabilities that we don't have. Let's actually create an oh shit moment for management in terms of, you know, giving them a better understanding of how vulnerable we really are, and then using that as a forcing function to you know, enable better response, better defense, all those different other things down the chain.
Katie, have you had much contact with organizations that have run bounties and had bad experiences, and now they're coming to you to sort of look at how they can improve, you know, their readiness or get better value out of them? Have you seen it done wrong?
I've definitely seen organizations get in over their heads very, very quickly. So far, those ones are, they're kind of like once bitten, twice shy right now. But I'm hoping that, you know, with more and more bounty service providers out there to make things easier for people to manage, that, you know, they'll give it another try. But yeah, I've definitely seen them get overwhelmed. And it's a bad experience for both the organization and the hackers. The hackers are not pleased if a program gets spun up and then shut down really quickly.
So what sort of mistakes have you seen? Is it always in terms of the readiness? We're going to talk about integrating readiness into an SDLC, which seems the logical place to do it, in a moment. But is that really the number one pitfall for anyone considering doing this sort of thing?
Well, I think the number one pitfall is that they had no idea how many vulnerabilities they would actually have. And especially if they have some low-hanging fruit, the amount of duplicate submissions that they get is kind of a big thing to struggle with as well. So even if it's relatively few vulns, but they're low-hanging fruit, easy to find, you're going to get a rush of hackers who report the same vulnerability. Only the first one typically gets paid. And you've got a bunch of unhappy hackers, and you still have like an inbound volume of the same case over and over again that you haven't quite fixed. So I've seen that go down a few times.
Yeah, Casey, how do you actually deal with that from a keeping the crowd happy point of view? Because I imagine that when someone submits like a rubbish app, which is going to happen a lot of the time because people are going to view bounties as like a quick fix to all of their security ills. You know, they say, here's 10 grand or 20 grand or whatever, and that's going to fix everything. And yeah, there's trivial SQLI that someone finds, and of course it gets reported by five people. Like, how do you keep people happy when they're reporting dupes? Because I imagine it would cause a lot of people to feel like they got burned.
It's not just the dupes. It's really anything that is not of direct value to the person on the receiving end. And the thing of it is, the way that we kind of structured this right from the start is that the community management component of making this all work is actually going to be a bigger challenge, and one that's actually, it better lends itself to aggregation than getting vulns from place to place. Because at the end of the day, you are saying no a lot of the time. You do have, a community that is known for being pretty volatile when it feels like it's been slighted.
I just love how you're in diplomat mode right now. It's quite hilarious.
I'm totally
but
in diplomat
continue.
Mode, man. But it is true, right? Like hackers don't like feeling ripped off, and they don't like feeling like they've been duped, or like duped as in tricked, right? So the key to it is really clear expectation management, making sure that all of that stuff is as clear as possible up front and before it gets started.
I imagine this is like about, the maturity level of the crowd collectively, right? I can imagine this would have been more of an issue a year ago than it is today.
I wouldn't say that, because I think the thing is, you've got people that are experienced that are kind of making up the body of the folk that work on this stuff, and then you got all the folks that are joining it as a part of the gig economy.
And I found the SQLI, give me my money, goddammit. Yeah, right.
And those new entrants don't necessarily get there's this sense call it within the herd of the need to protect itself. So you do see a lot of that kind of self-regulating behavior and different things like that. But, really what it comes down to, what we do about it, is put a lot of effort into making sure that people are getting answers to questions when they ask them. Because at the end of the day, regardless of whether or not the submission from a researcher is useful to a company or not, that person has gone and done work that they think is valuable for you for free, and you've committed to them that you'd respond. So, at the end of the day, it's like, regardless of if you're going to fix the vuln or whether it's useful or a dupe or whatever else, that person actually deserves an answer, because that's what you told them you'd do. And as long as you can hold up that end of the bargain, then things tend to work out pretty well.
Katie, it's been a hell of a change for you, going from being full-time with HackerOne into now working with different bug bounty companies like your sworn, until recently sworn enemy, Casey Ellis here. What's that experience been like, going from working for one player to then taking on a role that's more sort of across the whole industry?
Well, the policy role that I took with HackerOne was very much to defend this industry and make sure that hackers that I know and love do not get incarcerated or prosecuted for, legal or regulatory violations, and to keep the legal and regulatory landscape friendly towards bug bounties and this new defense economy for zero days. So even my work, at my previous company was really designed to benefit the ecosystem as a whole. So for me, it's not actually been that big of a transition. Plus, Casey and I were friends before, and we were friends during, and we're friends now. So it's all
true story.
Oh, he told me a different story altogether, Katie. I've got the chat log somewhere. I'll dig them up and I'll send them over to you.
Frenemies during is how I've always been a big fan of Katie's work, despite her career choices at points along the way.
Now, look, let's talk about this. Let's talk about this SDLC response readiness. Is this something, Katie, that is now an established process? Like, is there a template that you can give people? Is there a book on how to do this in terms of integrating a response capability into development processes, or is it still sort of being made up along the way?
So So there was, you know, there was a book on the SDL that was written by Steve Lipner and Michael Howard.
Yeah.
But that book was really concentrating on the, you know, old school style of software development, and it didn't have a lot on agile or web development as we see it today, and certainly not mobile development as we've seen. So I think that there's an updating of processes and integration that needs to happen for a much more dynamic software development type of environment, where you're not going to have that waterfall style programming that lends itself to a big process like the SDL. So you see variations come up, but I think right now it is very much being defined, because you could have the most secure software in the world, but if you were the last one to market because you were doing all of these like proactive security steps to build it, you're still going to lose. So there's a commercial pressure there to make sure that, you know, you're developing software quickly and that it's relevant, and ideally it's the most secure you can make it. And that's, I think, where bug bounties really can help.
I want to ask both of you, you know, because really between the two of you, I mean, this is probably the one interview with the most combined experience in years of people dealing with this stuff, especially considering Katie's along, because, you know, your experience with Microsoft pioneering this stuff, you know, you certainly paved the way for the industry that followed. Where do you see this stuff going over the next 5 years? We've seen where it's come over the previous five, and it's been quite amazing. You know, we've got the Pentagon doing bug bounties and things like that. Where do you see it going for the next 5 years? We'll start with you, Casey. What do you think?
I mean, it's shifting from novelty to conventional wisdom is sort of what I see. You know, the conversations that we're having with all sorts of customers, like this started off in the early adopting kind of tech community, right? And we spend a lot of time talking to more traditional organizations where, you know, it's not so much just a bug bounty thing, but the whole idea of distributed resourcing and crowdsourcing as a way to find vulnerabilities more effectively, you know, is something that they need, right? And what we're seeing now is the conversation that, you know, we have with like Fortune 500s and people of that kind of nature is it's more about when than if. Like it's shifted.
So, Katie, do you agree with that, that essentially what's happening is bug bounties are transitioning from being something on the edge that's really cool into being something that's going to be quite mainstream?
It's definitely picked up a lot of mainstream momentum. I think, you know, certainly with Microsoft moving over into that category of welcoming bug bounties, and then the Department of Defense, those are some pretty big indicators that the market is ready for more bug bounties. Where I see there's a risk is that, you know, I'm concerned that more conservative organizations will try and do a much closer to a penetration testing model where they're still trying to control.
They're trying to limit scope and make it useless. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, or try and limit the inflow of who can even, you know, go after their targets. And it's like that's useful as a transitionary step. I think that's an incredibly valuable way to do things as you're getting into it. But what I worry about is that the trend will be towards this more conservative end, and that'll be where the majority of bug bounties are executed under this like NDA type of moment. What I think can push that back is, you know, organizations demanding of their own suppliers that they offer, you know, at least some way to contact them to report vulnerabilities, as in vuln disclosure program. And then from there, I think it will be a matter of not if but when that they do a bug bounty. If they're already open to the public reporting vulnerabilities in general and not, you know, kind of restricting that, I think that is going to be the biggest indicator of how many more organizations we can get just doing that, of whether or not this is going to be a true open global bug bounty economy, like I know that, you know, Casey and I both want to see happen.
So I guess, yeah, from there, moving from accepting bugs to soliciting them, it's, you know, a baby step at that point. Well, Katie Massouris, thank you very much for joining us on the show to have a chat about all things bug bounty. Casey Ellis as well. This has been fantastic having both of you together here on the program to share your collective expertise on the topic. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks, Pat.
Thank you so much for having us.
That was Katie Massouris, bug bounty consultant, and Casey Ellis, chief executive of BugCrowd there with this week's sponsor interview. Big thanks to both of them. And that is actually it for this week's show. I hope you've enjoyed it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.